Please feel free to speak up any question or comment or anything at any time. If something I say that's not clear, you want to clarify. We are looking forward to this reunion next month. We had a little trial run 2 years ago this August. Had about nearly 100 people here. This August, we're expecting about 150. And everybody will be in their 70s or 80s. Because we cut it off at 1945. Those were involved up to 1945. When we were trying to put a list together, those to invite, I asked Harold DeGroff, who ran the Navigator Home in Honolulu for 9 years, if he had kept a list of people who had been in his home that we might get some names and addresses from. He said, well, I do. He said, I kept a record of everybody who came to my home during those 9 years, and there are 26,000 names on that list. So we're not going to have all 26,000 of those here.
The Navy was really flocking in there. Didn't
it? Yeah, that was that one home in 9 years. There, you're aware there are two excellent books that give a lot of information on Dawson Troutman and the Navigators. Betty Skinner's book, Doss, which is a documentary, and Bob Foster's book, The Navigator, that gives more about Dawson Troutman himself. Now, I want to ask and answer two or three questions and then just give some information that I trust will be of interest. And my first question be, why is there Navigators today? And I'd like to answer that with a quotation from a man named D.E. Host, who was the successor to Hudson Taylor as a director of the old China Inland Mission. He says, his sentences are British, kind of long and need a little editing. I'll read the way he wrote it, then I'll explain what he said. He said, when God raises up a man for special service, he first works in that man the principles which later on are, through his labors and influence, to be the means of widespread blessing to the church and to the world. Now, I think that's kind of complicated. But what he's saying is, when God gets ready to bless the church and the world by a set of principles, he raises up a man and then works those principles out through his life, which later will be a blessing to the church and to the world. So I think that's what happened. God wanted the church and the world to be blessed, and so he picked out a man, worked out in his life the things that he wanted to be perpetuated, and today are continuing to be a blessing to many. Now I want to give a couple of secular accounts of the Navigators. And I think Jim referred to this morning. This is a copy of an article that appeared in Collier's magazine. The year, the issue was September 13, 1941. So you can see that was 3 months before World War II started. I don't know if anybody in the room here remembers when Collier's magazine was circulated. Remember that? Nickel a copy. It was probably the most widely circulated weekly in the U.S., an overall news magazine. Don't think there's anything like it today. It was a combination of several things that are in effect. In 1940, actually all through the late 30s, the general state of public opinion against the military service was very bad. Not quite as bad as it was after the Revolutionary War. There was 1 year that the Congress refused to appropriate any money for the Army. And anybody that served that year served without pay, and as far as I know, they never got it back. Well, in the 30s, I remember 1 year that we stayed at anchor for one full year in Long Beach Harbor, battleship I was aboard, because the Congress would not appropriate any money for fuel to maneuver. So there was a strong pacifistic feeling. And in about 1940, the admiral commanding the Asiatic Fleet asked for $5 million to build an air base on Guam because he knew the Japanese were fortifying the islands around. And four congressmen went together to pass a resolution requesting the Navy court-martial him for being a warmonger. So you can see what the state of the public was towards supporting the military. Well, the Navy decided to go directly to the public, and so they invited about a dozen of the leading newspaper editors to make an expense-free trip around the Pacific, just so they could see the state of our defense and see what the Japanese were doing, and try to create some interest in getting some more money. So one of the people they selected was Walter Davenport, who was the political editor of this magazine, Collier's. And I have here the first article that he wrote on his expense-paid tour by the Navy, and it's called Onward Christian Sailors. And there's a big picture of Dawson Trotman. It says, they pray as they work, they sing unto the Lord as they go down to the sea, they rejoice with left hooks when men revile them, and they're just enlisted men in the United States Navy. Stephen Decatur turns in his grave, John Paul Jones rubs his hollow eyes, Farragut stops damning torpedoes. It's amazing. So the Navy Department was not too pleased with Mr. Davenport's first article because it dealt with the navigators. He was going to sail from San Francisco to Honolulu on the battleship California. And he went out on Sunday afternoon. The ship was to leave Monday. And he was talking with the chief petty officer who escorted him around. And they were just talking. And then in his article he says, we grabbed Mr. Murphy's arm. That was his escort. Interrupting him, Gobbs, your gentleman, we had just seen something. Four sailors, trim as new sloops, but with their faces set in grim lines, were about to go over into the boat in a body. Under their arms, clamped tightly to their ribs, they carried Bibles. Just before they descended into the cutter, one of them, a little taller than the others, prayed. We guess that he was 25 years old. He had a hawk face, wide shoulders, big hairy hands, and one glance told you that it would be bad judgment indeed to ask him to step out into the alley. His sharp, weathered face lifted toward the clean, cool sky that domed San Francisco Bay. His eyes closed, his lips moved, his companions bowed their heads. The silent prayer lasted but a moment, and then all four went over, stern, aloof, resolute. Navigators, explained Mr. Murphy. They're new, too. We've got about 12 of them on the California, maybe 15, you can't tell. Today you've got 12, maybe 15, tomorrow you've got 18 or 20. Now here was his concept. He said, they're always working on the wicked, converting sinners, holding revivals, praying with lost souls. Every ship in the fleet's got some. I don't know how many in all, and they ain't saying. I ain't saying that they have converted some of the officers of the fleet, and I ain't saying that they haven't. I ain't saying it's a good thing, although religion never hurt any man, including sailor. And I ain't saying it's bad. But I do say there's a time for praying, there's a time for working. Trouble is, you can't tell with these navigators when they're going to quit praying and work, although many of the time I've seen them do both at once. Well, he says, the fellow you saw praying, he's the missionary. Would you like to meet him? And so Mr. Davenport said, yes, he'd like to meet him. Now, I was in Hawaii at the time that Mr. Davenport came out on the California, and I met this man that he interviewed. And he told me, he said, I had a great opportunity to give my testimony to some civilian that was on the California. And he said, you know, kind of worried me. He said, he wrote down everything I said. And he never knew that he was being interviewed for an article in a magazine, so he was just natural. Well, Mr. Davenport asked him about the navigators. So he says, before going to our conversation with Mr. Bell, it might be well if you knew what and who the navigators are. Mr. Bell, the missionary, insists that it isn't a religion in itself, nor is it a distinct denomination, having no organization as such. It isn't a cult, having no specific rites nor peculiar ceremony. Mr. Bell, a man of comprehensive simplicity, was unable to state a clear definition, but said that one could be a navigator in any church wherein was preached pure fundamentalism, and wherein the Bible was accepted literally from the first word of Genesis to the last amen of Revelation. He told us about 10 or 12 years ago, Mr. Dawson Chapman, living then at the gates of the United States Navy Reservation in Long Beach, California, founded the Navigators. Mr. Chapman worked in a lumberyard. In his moments of leisure, he was accustomed to drink liquor, smoke, much more than's good for him, and occasionally give tongue to a number of full-bodied oaths. Mr. Chapman, who is now living in Los Angeles, admits to all of this. Then he says, like Paul bound for Damascus, breathing out threatenings and slaughter against the disciples of the Lord, Mr. Chapman stopped all this in his tracks, renounced Satan, quit the lumberyard, and began redeeming sailors from sin. The Lord smiled upon his work from the beginning. Starting with a new strength, a new faith, a worn Bible, and four sailors, Mr. Chapman is now the head of a way of life. Mr. Bell refuses to let us say organization. That is followed by hundreds of blue jackets, the Navigators. In the beginning, there was but one shore station where navigators might get together for Bible reading, prayer, and testimony. It was Mr. Trotman's quarters in Long Beach boarding house. But Mr. Trotman took to religion with the same headlong vigor that had characterized his unregenerate life. Today, from Bremerton, Washington, to San Diego, California, and to Honolulu and Manila, the Navigators wage an all-out war on Beelzebub. And the Lord has blessed their passion measure for measure. They have no real estate to call their own, but scores of churches and missions, all of them dedicated to vociferous evangelism and uncompromising fundamentalism, call them brother. Well, he said a lot of other things that he learned from Bell. The last thing in here, as he was getting ready to leave the ship, he said he saw him out there, and he said to him, but just outside his quarters, we ran into ship fitter second class Bell. Mr. Bell told us he was glad to meet us. He smiled serenely and shook hands. Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, he bade us, and thou shalt be saved. Good luck, Mr. In these days, it was not common, as some of you know, to see scripture and see a testimony like this in a secular magazine. Well, that was one view of how the Navigators got started. I'll pass this around. You might want to look at that picture and give it back to me. In Time magazine, July 2nd, 1956, after Dawson had been drowned the 18th of June, the feature article in the religious section was on the Navigators and Dawson Chapman. It says, at 18, Los Angeles-born Dawson Chapman, as he later recounted, gambled and was very deep in the world. He was courting a girl named Lila, as religious as she was pretty, and she took him with her to some church meetings. At the second meeting, Dawson was the only one there who had memorized six Bible verses that had been assigned at the first meeting. The same thing happened at the third meeting. The following week, he was taken of the Lord, converted to evangelistic Christianity, and welcomed membership in the Church of the Open Door. Memorizing the Bible was the key to conversion, as Chapman saw it. So he handed out scores of scriptures to youth groups he organized. One day in 1934, a mother asked him to look up her son, a sailor on a ship off Long Beach. Sitting in his old car by the waterfront, Chapman quoted the Bible to the boy until a policeman grew suspicious. A few minutes later, Chapman had talked the cop into joining him and the sailor in a session of prayer. The sailor said, "I'd give my right arm if I could do what you just did." Dawson challenged him to try. When Spencer was here 2 years ago, we gave him the feature opportunity to give his account of what was just described, and we have it on tape. And we questioned him all we could to make sure that we got this down for history. And he added a few things that, or he clarified a few things that have kind of grown as the years have gone on, that they were parked in the car, and the policeman came along thinking they had liquor. And so they had the keys to the schoolhouse. He was a night watchman at a schoolhouse. So they actually went in a classroom and turn on the lights. And so he talked to him in the classroom rather than out in the car, as most of this indicates. Well, he goes on to say after that, Trautman and the sailor, it was the beginning of a movement that Trautman called the Navigators for its nautical origins. For that sailor converted a friend with the technique he had learned from Dawson Trautman, and that convert in turn convinced another. Soon navigators were spread across the seven seas. At one point during the war, there were navigators in more than 1,000 U.S. Navy ships and stations. Evangelist Graham urged Dawson Trautman to join his Fort Worth crusade in 51 and ask him how to keep people to their religious conviction once they had made their decisions and signed the cards. Navigator Trautman organized a system of Bible instruction courses, B-rations, for verses to be memorized. Graham and his team have used them ever since as the core of their systems for following up Graham converts. Now I think you'll enjoy this last paragraph especially. In 1953, Trautman bought a large, luxurious ranch at Colorado Springs and turned it into a national headquarters and free vacation spot for navigators. Then they quoted Billy Graham. Last week, Billy Graham summed up with what many Christians in many places in the world were saying about Doss Trautman. "I think Doss has personally touched more lives than anybody that I have ever known," said he. "He lived to save others," said a navigator. "His death was just the way he would have planned it." And in the early part of the article, it gives the details of how he was in a boat with, there were nine people in the boat. There were only two seats in the boat. And so to make room, the people in the rear seat slid forward, and Dawson and the two girls sat with their feet on the seat, sat up on the back. He knew these two girls couldn't swim, so he said, "Well, let's hold together here so nobody will fall off." But the boat took a sudden turn, hit a wave, and the girl on the outside fell off. I pulled him off. He got loose, the one on the inside, and he knew she couldn't swim. That's where he was sitting by her. So he used his last strength holding her up. They pulled the boat back around and pulled her out. And when they pulled her out of his arms, they said his hands just drifted apart because he had used the last ounce of his energy to save her. So the caption in Time magazine underneath his picture said, "Always holding someone up." And that had been a good motto for him. Okay, that's those histories that have some degree of accuracy. In them, I'll try to point out some of the things that are not that accurate. Now, I want to continue this idea of why there's navigators today. Shortly after securing this property, there was down in the last canyon down here where that greenhouse is, there was a fire. It was a very dry summer that year, and it got out of hand, almost burned some of the buildings. They had some volunteer help. And I think maybe the city sent out some help, but they extinguished the fire before it did any damage, other than burn the grass, didn't burn any buildings. So after it was over, Trautman, of course, wanted to know how the fire got started. So he got the crew together. Now, I was not in that meeting, but everybody that was remembers it very vividly. Back in that canyon, one of the former owners of this property had built an incinerator. He took concrete reinforcing rods and wired expanded metal around to make panels. So they put three of these panels together, and the front panel was wired so you could use it for a gate, and had another panel over the top. So this was a pretty junky-looking enclosure, but they used it as a place to burn papers, you know, so they wouldn't fly out, kind of an outdoor incinerator. Well, over the years, the wire had rusted, and thing kind of fallen apart, and there were several gaps between the roof and the side. But somebody that, after navigators had moved here, thought that was, that was incinerators. So that's where you're supposed to burn papers, so they continued to burn papers. Well, on this day, somebody burned some papers, and wind caught one just right, you know, and went up through the hole and set a grass fire outside. Now, when Dawson found out what had caused it, he had a very low tolerance for stupidity. And the very idea that an intelligent person would start a fire in that enclosure that had holes in the roof was something that he just could not bring his mind to believe. So he talked to the fellows about it a little bit. And about the third time around, you know, each time he reviewed how stupid this was, he got a little more animated. And the guys have been working pretty hard, and they're kind of tired, so they've kind of, tension began to drift off. But he got them back to attention in a hurry. And this is what he said. He said, "You think that I'm a perfectionist." And he said, "You're right. I am." He said, "If I were not a perfectionist, there would not be a Navigator ministry today." So that's his own evaluation of why the Navigators came about. Now, probably in a conference this size, there are several perfectionists. And if you're one of them, you know that you're not the easiest person to live with. And people around you know that too. Because a perfectionist always believes that there's a better way to do something. You know, no matter how good this seemed to be working, there must be a better way. So Dawson Trotman, this was his whole life, something that was perfectly acceptable and productive when he went to bed. By the time his subconscious had meditated on it the next morning, he felt there must be a better way to do it. So in his own Christian life, he started out as a very disciplined person. He tried to figure out what it was that made him vital. And one of the things he came up was the wheel illustration. He instinctively knew from the very beginning that if the gospel was really going to make an impact during his generation, it would take a lot of people to do it. It wasn't one man's job. So he recruited as many young men as he could like him to help put him into a team. Well, one of the things they organized, one team he had was called the Minutemen. And he got that term from Revolutionary War people, you know, the Minutemen that were ready to be called to battle. And among the things that they were supposed to do, here's an account in his journal of a meeting they had, August 28, 1932. Nine duties were listed in the following order. Memorize a verse a day. Have an hour a day with the Lord, touch a life a day, have a definite work to do each week, keep a journal, have ammunition ready, have team business up to date, read 2 hours a week, tackle a lone task. So September 4th, the next week, they had a meeting and decided that these duties were too strenuous. So they added three more. Memorize one half a hymn a week, review 7 verses a day, spend some definite time on our filing system. So he laid it heavy on himself and heavy on the other people, with the result they began to lose them. Bob Munger, when he was here preaching the dedication for Glen Eyrie, said, "Discipline without desire is drudgery." So this is pretty much what happened, and they fell away, and he was left alone again. Matt took one of the fellows who was, I think, the most promising, and named Walt Stanton, and he said, "Would you meet and pray with me?" And so Walt said, "I'd be glad to." And he said, "Okay, I'll pick you up at 3:30 in the morning on the motorcycle." And Walt thought he said 3:30 and found out he did. So he picked him up at 3:30 on his motorcycle, and they went to a little place out in the canyon by Lomita, California. We've gone up there and built in the canyon, but there's houses all around you. You can just barely find it. But they built a fire in this little canyon, parked his motorcycle, and prayed from 4 to 6. Now, as I understand, the objective of the prayer meeting was to pray for these other fellows that had fallen by the wayside. Now, this went on day after day. I don't know how many times that you've been in a two-hour prayer meeting just once, much less every day, and where you've got only a few people to pray for. You know, the second or third day, you've prayed several times everything you can possibly think of for every one of them. So after they had got them saturated, they said, well, there must be, well, we know some other people with signs these. So they prayed for people they knew in neighboring cities. And the burden still didn't lift. And so then they said, well, there must be people like these we've prayed for in other cities. So they prayed for people they didn't know in other cities. But the burden didn't lift. And pretty soon they had prayed for young men. You know, the same prayer they'd prayed for their own teammates in every city of the United States. I mean, every major city. At least one or more cities in every state. But the burden didn't lift. So the last few days, they brought a map of the world down and put their finger on various countries of the world and cities, asking that God would raise up that same kind of young man in each of those places. Now, I asked Dawson once if he remembered what cities they put their finger on and prayed. And he remembered a few of them, but not all. But I think there's evidence today to those of us that travel around the Navigator world in the 54 countries that we're in that we could probably see some of those places that were prayed for. Well, after about 6 weeks, you know, the burden lifted, so they went on their regular way. By the way, they didn't pray that long on Sunday. They slept until 6 and then got up and prayed 4 hours, I think it was, till 10, from 6 to 10. Well, you know, this kind of was a closed chapter. And then Dawson Trotman met this sailor that both the accounts had something to say about. And here Dawson Trotman found a young man who for the first time in his life was responsive to everything that he had to say. And Lester Spencer bought the whole package and began to do it. Well, it wasn't long before that the witnessing spoke. We came into, you know, under his challenge. So he reached another fellow. And both of these fellows were Christians before they came in the Navy. They came in the Navy to save money, go to college and seminary, and be ministers, both of them. Well, the second fellow, Gurney Harris, had been in the Navy about 3 years, and his vision had slipped a little bit. So the other part of the story is that Spencer took him over to Dawson Trotman. His name was Harris, and he said, now here's a man that needs what you've been teaching me more than I needed it. Now I want to turn him over to you. And Trotman, you know, well, that's a logical thing to do. But in what we think was a very historic moment, Dawson said, why don't you teach him? And Spencer, oh, I could never do that. And Trotman got serious, and he said, if you can't teach him what I've taught you, then I have failed. I've done a poor job with you. Now I'm going to start all over again with you until you can teach him everything I've taught you. So that's the way they went about it. And pretty soon there were others added, and I was number 6 in the sequence. I grew out of these first two, then there were 2, then there was 1, and then I came into the picture. And all 4 of these, first 4 that he contacted, worked on me. And we had them all 4 here last August. If you use...
Once you read through it again, Grant.
Yeah, well, the first guy was Lester Spencer. And the next fellow was Gurney Harris. Gurney went to Africa as a missionary. He died of cancer about 4 years ago. The next fellow was... 2 of them came together. Ed Goodrick and a fellow named John Dedrick. Now, if you have a NIV concordance of the Bible, you'll notice that the name at the top was E.W. Goodrick. Well, he's a fellow that put together the NIV concordance. And then his buddy, Dedrick, is still in his middle 70s, a missionary to the Indians in Mexico. He went with Wycliffe. Then the fifth fellow was a fellow named Virgil Hook, and he will be here. He's the fellow that really influenced me the most for Christ. He went to Tibet for 7 years, and he made some kind of a contact out there where the Dalai Lama adopted him as his son and gave him a little card showing that he was a part of his family. For 7 years, he had unrestricted access to Tibet. And anytime anybody questioned what he was doing, just pull out this card, you know, show that he was an honorary family of the Dalai Lama. So he had a good ministry in Tibet for 7 years before he had to leave. He now lives in Paradise, California, which is a nice sounding name, isn't it? Many missionaries, I think that no retirement program, not much of a retirement program, so he works part-time as a prison chaplain now. And by the way, these fellows, they're coming this next month, with all except one. You know, it's been took a couple of years of financial planning just to be able to get here. Okay, now, as a result of the ministry of these people, hundreds began to come to Dawson's Trotman's home, and later, as I mentioned, thousands in the Honolulu home and these other homes around. Dawson Trotman always tried to make people very special. So when people come to his home, he gave them a sheet of paper on a clipboard, and everybody had to sign their name, their home state, their ship, and their birthday. You know, so he could have an excuse to get in contact with them, send a birthday card on their birthday. So he had those four columns. Well, he accumulated, after having people in two or three times a week, quite a large sheaf of these papers. So one day, he got ready to discard them. He noticed several states. So he thought, I'm going to check off and see how many states have been represented. And he found that there had been men from every one of the then 48 states in his living room. And one of his tapes, he mentions that men from every one of the 48 states had made decisions for Christ in his living room. Well, not too hard to put things together, is it? Here, he prayed for 6 weeks for young men in every state of the Union. And he sat right there. God brought him into his living room.